Come, spellweavers, reavers, rogues, and men-at-arms, and answer the call of adventure. Pick up your sword, your axe, your spellbook, your bow, your rulebook, and your dice, and join the forces of good in their eternal fight against vile monsters, conspiring min-maxers, horny bards, and blood-soaked murder hobos. Discover the treasure trove of role-playing games here on Rollin' Bones. My name is Ryan Howard, and I shall be your guide. Good evening, boneheads, and welcome back to Rollin' Bones with Ryan Howard, where we are making old school young again. I'm your host and king of the boneheads, Ryan Howard, and I am very excited about tonight's conversation. We have with us Mr. Wargaming, aka John Mollison. I am very excited to talk a little bit about some of the roots of role-playing games and how the two concepts of RPG and role-playing game are not separate, but actually linked in some intrinsic way. And along the way, we'll probably talk about several other things. But before we bring John on, I just want to remind everyone that you can find Rollin' Bones on X and Instagram at Howard_RyanGregg. On YouTube, I am Rollin' Bones. Twitch is twitch.tv/RollinBonesRyan. And Substack is RollinBones.substack.com. My Substack is the place where you can find kind of my unfiltered, unfettered ramblings on the topic of role-playing games. I will tell you guys, I have a very spicy topic lined up for my article tomorrow. I am going to be writing an article in defense of the adversarial GM, and I will say nothing more about that and tell you guys to read the article because I'm excited about this one. I'm excited to see kind of what people say about it. Also want to remind everyone that you can get your Rollin' Bones merch at TeePublic over on the Bonehead Emporium. You will find the link over here in chat. And if you are listening to this or watching this after the fact, you can find those links pinned in the YouTube comments. So that's enough with my shilling here. I want to go ahead and bring on tonight's guest. You can find him on Twitter at NotJohnMollison. He is Mr. Wargaming, the host of the Joy of Wargaming channel over on YouTube. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Rollin' Bones, Mr. Wargaming, John Mollison.
Hey, and thanks for having me on, Ryan. It's a pleasure.
Oh, no problem. It's great to have you on. So, John, we're going to kick off tonight's show the same way we start all these shows. I've got questions everyone gets asked when they come on Rollin' Bones for the first time. So how did you get into, we'll say, both wargaming and role-playing games?
Big Brother, you know, as a child of the 80s, that's the case. I remember the very first time I played Dungeons & Dragons was crammed around a little kitchen table. We fought kobolds. I had a sling, and I didn't know what it meant. I thought it meant a slingshot. I believe my halfling died. My parents were very well read, and they introduced me to literature and exposed me to the earliest fantasy I remember was probably Lord of the Rings, the old Rankin Bass Hobbit. And one day, walking around downtown South Bend, we passed a store. It was a used bookstore that had some of these newfangled games, and I saw the little miniature sitting in the window. It was the old Mithril miniatures lineup of 25 mil. Walked inside. Love at first sight, just never looked back, never stopped. Just kept exploring the hobby for the last probably 45 years now.
Gotcha. And already in chat, Crafty Matt says, that's not John. John is just a pair of hands.
Yeah, well, I'm a little jealous. You know, Ryan Howard is putting me to shame here with his lovely setup. He's got intros, and I've just got, like, I just cram into a tiny little box and just, you know, tell stories with paper and pencil, kind of the way we all do around the table, right? You squeeze in the time that you can, and you make the best that you can with what you got.
Absolutely. And Crafty also could not resist getting in a Go Irish. He is a big time supporter of America's backup quarterback factory over at Notre Dame. So,
Nobody's perfect.
Absolutely. Anyway, the next question that I have for you, because, you know, those of us who spend a lot of time doing this, you know, there's not a lot of money to be made in the RPG world. You know, we're not going to be millionaires here. We do this because we love the game, and that love comes from fond memories we have of playing it. So if you had to pick a fondest RPG memory, what would that be?
Oh, man, over the last 40 years, is your fondest memory? I don't know. That's a great question. I wouldn't even know where to begin to answer that question. Can I answer a slightly different question?
Sure.
They say the golden age of comic books and, you know, I would say RPGs is the age of 10, and I don't find that to be true at all. I recently crossed the 50-year mark, and I am having more fun with this hobby now than I ever have. That probably the most fun I've had has been in the last few weeks over on the channel. So for those that don't know, I recently suffered a debilitating eye injury, and I have no depth perception, so I'm unable to paint miniatures, and I'm even like grabbing stuff on the table is difficult for me because I constantly misjudging distances. So I've shifted over and I've been playing a solo AD&D campaign live on camera and taking advice and letting viewers call the shots. And I've discovered a lot of fun things about AD&D. I've been playing the game off and on. I mean, you know, I played it back in the 80s and took time off as we went through the progression of different editions of the game. And I've rediscovered my love of the game over the last few weeks. It's just been phenomenal. And I mean, a lot of that is due to guys like Ryan, guys like Crafty Matt that are teaching me new things about this game that I thought I knew intimately well. And it turns out I just don't. I'm constantly discovering new things. So, you know, my best memory, as you asked the question, it's that time I got to sit down with my buddy Ryan and talk to him about RPGs for an hour or so.
Nice.
And I mean that.
Awesome. I appreciate that. And speaking of Ryan's, Ryan Heffelfinger here in chat with a very timely question, as he is currently in the trenches on Twitter arguing this very point right now. He wants to ask you, how do you feel about using terrain generators in AD&D at the table?
Why wouldn't you? So this is the discussion that's been raging today.
Yeah.
Is on the one side, you've got a camp of the no prep enjoyers. And on the other hand, you've got the I only ever do prep outside of the session. And then, of course, you know, there's a whole vast gray area in between that we mostly ignore because it's kind of boring. It's a lot more fun to draw your party line, you know, line up and run at each other hoplite style.
Yeah.
So setting aside that fact, I am firmly in the camp of the no prep because time is limited. And if you generate content at the table, then you're guaranteed to interact with it. There's no wasted time. I don't have to generate 40 hexes and then wonder which hex will be used if I'm only generating hexes as they become relevant. It might take a minute or two longer to do that at the table, but I think that, remember when you use these generators, that the act of rolling the dice and creating the content is, I don't even think it's half of the game. It's not even half.
The hard part, right? What is this? And one of the topics is, what happens if you get a swamp right into a desert?
That led of, wait, does that happen in the real world? And we went, we looked, and we learned something about the real world. And yeah, it took a little longer to kind of justify it, but even that leads to something interesting. And because you're generating it at the table, it opens up an avenue for the players to help create the campaign. I'm a full advocate for it, where you say, where the DM says, wow, that's a strange result. What does that mean? And he throws it open to the floor. And whether or not the DM has the final, you know, say in the matter, now we're all participating in that act of creation. And this is part of being a generous gamer, is that it's not your campaign, it's our campaign. And that's one of the doors that those generators open. So I'm fully in the no prep camp. But, you know, again, with that caveat, that, yeah, that, you know, sometimes you have to do a little bit outside the session. And there are things that, you know, there's logistics
that need to be dealt with. Even in my solo AD&D campaign, there are things that I do off camera. As do you really want to see me scratching my head and doing math live as I figure out encumbrance? Forget that. We'll do that off camera, and then we'll get to the good stuff at the table a little sooner.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I used to be a prep guy. I have firmly found myself in the no prep camp for the very pragmatic reason of I now have a 16-month-old in my house. So if I'm going to run a game at all, you know, where am I going to find that time to prep?
Yeah, absolutely.
But something interesting that I found today, as I was watching some of your content, specifically the video about embracing chaos, there is something interesting about, you know, just kind of stumbling upon something that ought not be there, just in the players' minds. That in and of itself is a reason to push through, is a reason to, you know, find out why there's a desert in the middle of this, what we thought was an Arctic tundra. There's just a random, you know, hot desert here now. Find out why that is. Go in there and find out the reason why this kind of geographical anomaly exists. And then another, you know, point
we have a mystery on our hands.
And
it's a mystery for the DM too. I think the DM deserves to have those mysteries and gets to explore that space as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then the other point that you made in that video that I thought was interesting was kind of taking the distinction away from, you know, DM and player. Everyone's a player. A DM is just a different kind of player. So it's like you said, our campaign. It belongs to everyone at the table, and so everyone kind of has a say in what happens in the campaign. It's not just driven by what the DM decides to do. It's also, you know, the players' decisions now change the game world, because if they don't, then the players don't have any kind of impact on the world. So that's kind of an interesting point of letting players help, flesh out the world, and a detail that I think a lot of people overlook.
And this is part of the process of revealed preferences, right? The slightly insulting example is when you get in the car with your girlfriend or your wife and you say, where do you want to go? And there's this whole negotiation of, well, I don't care, you pick. And then you drive to the wrong place because it turns out they do care. Well, you don't have to worry about that if you've got this campaign that's in a quantum state, and or you're using the generator and you're generating a hex and the people aren't interested in that. So you generate a new one and they're not interested. You generate a new one and somebody goes, ooh. And now now I know what you want. You know, and you're asking them a decision. Do you stay and search this? No. Okay. You know, if you're firing off random NPCs, and one of the big complaints that you see in like kind of the conventional D&D crowd is, you know, I went to all this trouble to make this fully fleshed out NPC who fits perfectly. And then my players only want to interact with this thing I came up with on the fly. I don't even have a real personality. I just came up with a silly name. That's who they want. And I think you don't have a problem now. You know what your players want, and you were able to generate it instantly. This is the solution to your problem of over prepping. Listen to your players and give them what they want. And, you know, that kind of generous spirit, I think, goes a long ways towards any style of campaign you want to play. You just keep throwing things out until the players perk up. And we've all been at the table. We've seen it where they're like this. And then you throw out that paladin, that one-legged paladin with a patch and a parrot. And they go, pirate paladin? What's his name? And you come up with a goofball name off the cuff. And they're like, I want what he's having. Well, there you go. Now you know how to get them interacted. And, you know, if you know your players really well, if you've been playing with them for 30 years, you probably have the ability to anticipate beforehand. But, you know, particularly today when you're gaming online with a bunch of randos or guys you've only met for 6 months, just keep throwing stuff out until they pick something, until they interact with it. Then that's the ball you pick up and run with.
John, are you using a separate mic?
No, I'm using the inbuilt. Are we getting too much background noise?
No, it's not background noise. At some point, your mic kind of started, like, not glitching, but kind of coming in and out, and I don't know what it is, but we'll roll with it.
All right. Might be, it looks like, and I got four bars, so we should be okay.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll roll with it.
I'll turn my Wi-Fi on. We'll see if that works.
Okay.
All right. So I'm connected to the house Wi-Fi now. Maybe that clears it up.
And then Victor Gorchev here in chat. Mr. Wargaming is handsome. No one handsome plays with figurines. That is patently untrue. I can give you some evidence here in chat. Keelan plays with figurines. And I play with figurines, as you can see behind me. And it...
Yeah.
But yeah, we lost you there for a second. So anything you said, we didn't catch.
I didn't. We're good.
All right, cool. Anyway, as you know, your name suggests you are in fact a an expert in wargaming, some would say, most would say. And so I really wanted to talk with you about kind of the relationship that wargaming and RPGs have. And I think most people, even the most anti-wargaming RPG player will have to acknowledge there's no role-playing games without war games first. So can you explain to people who maybe aren't aware how wargaming plays into the origins of what we now know as fantasy role-playing?
Well, I suspect that most of your viewers, they're the kind of guy that tunes into a YouTube show that takes a topic like this and like they just start ripping it apart until they got grease up to the elbows and they bolt it back together. So I'm not really telling them anything they don't know when it comes to the history of RPGs. We all know that Gary Gygax was a miniature wargamer, and we all know that, you know, he developed chainmail, and out of chainmail, there was a little appendix in the back for use, and chainmail was originally a historical miniature wargame. You know, there was an appendix that had rules for fantasy races. What if we wanted dwarves and elves? And there was another little man-to-man rule set. And another guy named Dave Arneson took that man-to-man rule set and built a little skirmishy kind of game and a little more like talky-talky style of game. I think your listeners have generally been exposed to the concept of the Braunstein, where David Wesley basically built a proto role-playing game as an adjunct to a miniature war game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we all know that when you stand around a table, the miniature war gamers who take on the role of Napoleon will suddenly start talking with a bad French accent. The guys who are taking on the part of, you know, this is natural. It happens all the time. And, you know, as a natural progression of that, this new kind of game came up called role-playing games, where we said, and I think it's important to kind of step back and understand what it means to be in a role-playing game. You are making suboptimal tactical choices because you are fleshing out the character of your pawn. And I use pawn in the most loose sense possible here. And of course, suboptimal may be a conditional statement. Well, these guys are not really good in the woods, right? I've got cavalry. They don't charge through the woods. They're terrible in the woods. If you can catch them there, they're going to get slaughtered. Mm-hmm. But, you know, each of your little pawns has a different role to play. And even in miniature war games, like a unit would develop a personality. As you went to the table week after week, you would notice that this little group of 12 miniatures of horses, they actually do fight well in the woods. I can send them in the woods and they keep winning. Or, you know, they have a tendency to over pursue. I know this unit does, and they take on a personality. We as a big brained creature have evolved to be able to make connections. We are designed, if you prefer, or evolved to notice patterns. And so that happens with miniature war games. And eventually, you've got this natural progression into, well, what if I didn't have to worry about an army? What if I just worried about one guy? What if I just had to worry about, you know, what's Fafford doing today? What's Corum doing today? What's Conan doing today? You know, to kind of step back to that. And of course, skirmish games were a thing long before Dungeons and Dragons. You had gladiatorial combat games, and there's a balance between, you know, the more guys you have, the less complexity you can deal with on a per guy basis. When I'm dealing with the unit of 100 archers shooting at 100 horses, I'm not worried about where each guy's arm is and which part of the guy is armored. But if you and I each have a figure that's a gladiator in an arena, now I want to know, is he getting hit in the left arm? Is he getting hit in the right arm? Is he armored in the head? You know, what exactly is his weapon capable of? So you get this natural progression. And I think the problem, not really a problem, but there's a step that happens right at about 1980 where Gary Gygax is still in a chainmail mindset. And he hasn't realized that the idea of stepping into the role of a single character has a far broader appeal. And that the guys that he's turned over to do the like basic style of gaming, and I don't use basic, you know, it's not a derogatory, it's just a descriptive.
Yeah.
They've taken what he built and they're running with it in a whole different direction. And you get this weird hybrid game called Advanced Dungeons and Dragons that straddles the line between those two games in a way that few people recognize, because the newcomers to the hobby, this kind of second generation, have missed all of the wargaming aspect, and they're not familiar with managing the logistics of large armies and sending large armies across a tabletop. What they're familiar with is the movies they see, where the one hero or the hero and his band of plucky adventurers are trying to rescue the princess. And so they're mapping their experiences onto this game in a way that makes sense to them. And so the game winds up growing in a strange new direction. And what was the core becomes this useless appendage is probably a more negative way to say that, but it becomes a more of an adjunct or an appendix that gets lost along the wayside.
Yeah.
But it's still there. It's still buried in the heart of these games in a way that was lost for a very long time.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think you see the natural progression of that in like third edition so we probably talk about something like the purest form of that is where you have that acknowledgement in the Beckme series, where the later, right, you have the basic expert. When you get up into the CMI stage, there's an acknowledgement that you're leading armies. But until something like Birthright comes around, it really is just kind of a thing that people feel like you have to include. And let's get through it as fast as possible. And the rule encyclopedia, Aaron Alston, condenses major battles down to a single percentile.
Yep.
Well, you're cutting out huge aspects of planning and managing a war that were there up until the 1980s, and then we'll just put it in a percentile rule. And yep. Again, that's not to say that's a bad way to play. It's not to say that he did anything wrong, but it's different, and that's a different kind of game.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it definitely is, and you know, it's funny you mention people coming to the table kind of with these preconceived notions based on movies and books that they've, you know, seen and read. And when you consider that the game ultimately found its way into the hands of elementary and middle school children, it's kind of natural that as that generation grows up, they begin to evolve the game away from this core, because they were introduced to it as you get to play as Conan the Barbarian and Hawk the Slayer. And that's kind of how they interpreted the game. That's what they carried with them as they grew up. And so it makes sense that D&D evolves in the way that it does. However, there are a few of us these days who are now saying maybe that wasn't the best way to go for the game, and that's, or you know, certainly that's not what we enjoy about the game.
Sure. And there's something to be said for, I think one of the other issues here is that when you're reading a book, very rarely do you find the logistical challenges presented in an interesting way.
Right.
And, you know, when you talk about the heavy math, people aren't really interested. The typical gamer is not really interested in that. He sees that as a confounding factor. It's a thing I got to get through to get to the good stuff. Whereas, you know, the true, man, I hate to say autist, but, you know, there is a type of guy that just likes doing the math. He likes running the numbers. Mm-hmm. He likes setting up the dominoes. He likes setting up complex situations and then knocking them over and seeing what happens. And that is really a big part of the fun of this clash of armies and sending large bodies of troops off into the unknown to you know, carve out a new kingdom. But again, that's a different hobby than... How much time did we really spend worrying about how many coins were in Smaug's hoard? Like,
right.
It was a lot, and that's all we need to know. Now let's get back to the story. But, you know, if I need to know how many troops that can buy, if I need to know how I'm going to divvy up that hoard between the men of Lake Town, now that becomes interesting.
Yeah.
And that's where you have, you know, there's been countless examples of miniature war games playing out the Battle of Five Armies, and it's focused on that march of troops. But the D&D crowd much prefers that question of, okay, Bilbo has the Arkenstone, but you've got four different entities that have a reasonable claim to ownership, plus the one that has an unreasonable one that shows up at the last minute.
Yeah.
Right? Is it really the dwarves? Is it really the elves? Is it really the men of Lake Town? Who deserves that? Hmm. Oh man, there's orcs over there. They got here just in time that we can worry about the Arkenstone later. And, you know, to remind us that it's not as important as surviving to see tomorrow.
Right.
And so those are the two different kinds of games. And what's really interesting is that very few games can bridge the gap between those two games. Adventure Conquer King is about the only one of the old school revival games that manages that trick. And Alex Macris did that by breaking the game into three chapters. And he did it in a very sensible way. Again, you know, we keep coming back to Conan because he's the template, right? Hmm. Conan starts out as an adventurer, and then he becomes a conqueror, and then he becomes a king. And our characters go through that same growth. They start poking around in dank holes until they get enough money that they can raise a band of bros, or at least, you know, learn where the loot is to recruit them. And then once they have enough guys on their side, they can conquer some lands, and now I'm a king, and I got to worry about the other king. And AD&D does that as well. But because, you know, I think the benefit that Macris has is that hindsight that Gary suffered from the fact that he was the guy that was building this for the very first time. And I mean, I'm a huge fan, but he wrote his rules for guys that already spoke the language. Mm. There's a lot of things in there that go without saying because everybody already knows this. And then Alex comes along and goes, well, wait a minute. What if they don't know that? Maybe there's some things here that we should really talk about. And maybe we should, instead of starting with the March of Armies and assuming that you know how this is done, let's start small. Mm-hmm. And he kind of mimics Gary. You know, Gary's advice in the DMG, he says, you know, all you need is a village and a dungeon. That's all you need to worry about until the players get comfortable. And then once they get comfortable, they can hire, you know, war bands and start to explore the world. And then they'll find a place that they want to call home. And now they've got a home and now they're into the king phase. Well, Alex laid it out in a much more straightforward way for people that hadn't been introduced to that. Hmm. And so I think as a teaching tool, Adventure and Conquer King is excellent. I have nothing bad to say about it. But for my money, because I know the things that go without saying, that's why I focus more on AD&D right.
Yeah. And I think that's what's very important for people to understand, especially people of my generation. I am 27. So people of my generation, wargaming is not a popular thing. There's a couple people that have done it. About the best you can get is like Warhammer 40K, which whether or not that constitutes a full-blown war game is up to people's interpretation. Some say yes, some say no. But that's about the closest you get with people my age, aside from a couple outliers like, you know, my friend Keelan Halverson or, you know, a couple other people that I know. When people like us look at AD&D, without that context, it seems like there's something missing. And so it is useful to have a game like Axe to show us, okay, step by step, here's why things were, you know, set up the way they were, and here's the progression, here's how you go from point A to point B. But like you said, Gygax was writing for an audience that already understood that, because again, this D&D was introduced as a supplement essentially to the chainmail war game. So when you see certain things kind of make their way into D&D, even things that are still with us today, they come from a wargaming DNA. And it's still, even in, you know, fifth edition, even in the, you know, the least wargamey version of D&D that you can think of, you can still see the fingerprints of wargaming on the game.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the principles of wargaming can be applied to fifth edition. I know guys that do it. It's a bit, little bit of a heavier lift, and you do have the benefit in fifth edition that it is an incredibly robust system. It's very loosey-goosey, and you can add stuff in and take it out without really breaking the game in any way, because it's very malleable. And so, you know, I think you can add it, but you have to embrace a few principles that most of the player base aren't interested in or comfortable with. You have to manage the logistics of the army, right? Professionals think logistics, and, you know, and you... Let me give you a classic example of somebody that almost gets it but doesn't quite. Somebody about a year ago decided to rewrite the rules of chainmail and basically go through and copy edit them for clarity, and yeah, did an absolutely wonderful job making that rule set extremely readable, extremely clear, extremely concise. And anybody could pick that up and run with it today without any difficulties whatsoever, except the person who did that didn't include endurance. There was no rules for fatigue, which completely changes the nature of the game. And it's because the rules for fatigue were complicated, and this individual didn't really understand them. And I don't think understood how vital fatigue management is when you've got guys in heavy armor trying to chase down guys in no armor, right? And when you're trying to secure points on a battlefield, how fast your guys can move is not just a function of how quickly they run, but how long they can run quickly for. And so it really became an unplayable game. And I think that that same kind of thing happens today, where people say, well, I want to experience the clash of arms, but I don't want to manage the real challenges involved with that. And that's where you get, you know, cheat codes, where people say, well, you don't have to. All you have to do is just play the same game you are and just like put a painting of a battle in the background and then run the same battle you always run. Like your same skirmish fight in the foreground, and whatever happens in the skirmish fight, we'll pretend that that's a reflection of the backdrop. Well, but you haven't changed the game at all. You know, all you've done is reskin it. You're not, it's not a new experience in any way, shape, or form, because you haven't really changed the rules. You haven't really changed the ramifications. You really haven't changed anything about the activity itself. All you did, you know, you put lipstick on the pig. It's still a pig. So I would encourage more people to actually take some time and say, well, how far can an army move in a day? You know, if our two armies are both marching to the Temple of Elemental Evil, I know that they've got a force of orcs and bugbears that's going to arrive in 2 weeks. Can I get there in a week and beat them so that I can win the fight before the reinforcements get there? Will I be able to beat them? You know, will I be able to maintain my supply lines? That's an interesting question. If the opposing force has flyers, they can bypass my force and cut off the supply lines. That's a problem. That's an issue. And that's a problem. And problems are opportunities for adventure. And I think that opening up the complexity of war games would benefit players of all styles. And a great way to do that is to go back and look at AD&D. Look at how, you know, look at the movement rates. They're all listed. They're all right there. Port them out if you have to.
Yep, absolutely. Now, we do have a comment here from the Wonky, a.k.a. Keelan Halverson. He says he hasn't seen a single product that makes the rivet counting aspects of managing an army fun. And that when you get too bogged down in that mindset, that's where a lot of people kind of fall off of the wargaming side of things. And I guess that's kind of how wargaming essentially was kind of bred out of the minds of modern fantasy role playing. The way that I look at this question, and I'm not overly experienced with wargaming, but when it comes to role-playing games and having that kind of resource management aspect, the fun of that side of things comes in where you are low on resources and have to make hard decisions. And once you have made that hard decision, instead of agonizing over, you know, how many days worth of rations do I have to get my army to, you know, the point where they're supposed to be? It's the fun comes in when you have to make that hard decision of, we only have 3 days rations, but we need to make this 4 day march. And now we're having to go through the consequences of that forced march on short rations. That to me is where the fun kind of enters back in. And I think the best way to handle that, and the way that I hope more people will look at handling that as, you know, we try to design these things back into role-playing, is to force players into going, okay, yeah, it's a hard decision. Commanders have to make hard decisions. Now do it, and you'll have a hell of a story on the other side.
My response would be, if you're not interested in rivet counting, no set of rivet counting rules will appeal to you.
Right.
That fundamentally, that's the way this works. But rivets are an equalizer. Mm-hmm. And similar to time, they're a way of keeping score, and they're a way of ensuring that, you know, you use your resources to the maximum of your ability. Like you said, even that's an interesting question. We've got 3 days of food, and we were 4 days away from safety. That's a problem. Alternatively, I have two objectives that I have to meet, and I've only got the resources to meet one of them. Which one do I pick? And that's a question that comes up at every level of the game. So whether it's a question of, do we go left at the corridor or right at the corridor, knowing that we're on our last torch? Okay, do I seize the town on the left fork of the road or the right fork of the road? Which of those battles am I going to fight, knowing that if I split my forces, I lose them both?
Yep.
That's an interesting challenge. And if you're not tracking resources, if you're not interested in resource management, then maybe a resource management game isn't for you. That's perfectly fine. That's perfectly acceptable.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think what this gets to, and I've been trying to make this argument in multiple different ways over, you know, several months at this point. To me, the core essence of role-playing is, you know, you are embodying the mindset of the character in the circumstances that they're in. And in a lot of these games, your character's primary thoughts are about, how do I get out of this alive? And most of that comes down to, how do I manage the resources that I have on hand to keep myself alive in this situation? And so the ultimate conclusion of that is, the core of role-playing is resource management, because the forefront of your character's mind is, how do I come out of this alive?
The entire hobby is ultimately an infinite number of risk-reward analyses.
Yep.
What are my risks? How do I mitigate those risks to maximize the reward?
Hmm.
That's what the hobby's all about. And if we talk about, you know, this comes back to encumbrance, right? If I've only got enough space to carry 600 coins worth of stuff, which 600 coins worth of stuff am I going to take? That's an interesting question. It scales up. I've only got enough loot for 600 guys. I can hire 600 guys. Which 600 am I going to hire? Is it going to be 500 horsemen and 100 footmen? I might do that if I'm in, you know, a desert. If I need to move fast, that's what I might do. Mm-hmm. Do I need a good balance? Am I going to be in the mountains where having horses are a liability? You know, I may want to hire 50 horses just to like guard my supply lines, and spend the rest on 550 heavy foot. I know I'm fighting in narrow canyons the whole time. That changes my strategy. It changes the risk-reward balance. Exactly what am I seeking to achieve here, right? Am I hoping to loot a major city? If so, it doesn't matter if I loot it, if I spend more money on troops than they had in their coffers. It's the same thing. You've just scaled it up. And it's interesting in a game where, like, scaling up is the whole point of the exercise. We have different levels. It's baked into the cake. You're level one, and now you've got twice as many hit points because you're level two. Well, you're a general of a warband, and you successfully, you know, destroyed the Orcish fort, and you got a huge haul, and so you double the size of your warband. And what are you going to start doing? You're going to look for the next toughest guy. You're going to keep leveling up your armies. It's the same game.
Yeah. Yeah, and to quote Thomas Sowell in this case, in many of these cases, there are no solutions. There's only trade-offs. So
yes,
you're inevitably going to run into all you have are bad options. And I think what a lot
which
of people
is the least bad.
Yeah. And I think what a lot of people try to do, and why, to get back to Keelan's point, bean counting becomes so tedious and irritating for people. You have people who think they can essentially bean count their way out of a struggle. And the fact of the matter is you're dealing with a military simulation, and there is no military in the history of warfare that has been able to resource manage their way out of conflict, essentially.
Right. And there's countless examples of countries that have been able to spend their way to victory, only to discover that they've ultimately lost because they overspent. That's the thing that happens all the time, you know, where you bankrupt yourself defending yourself. And, okay, great, militarily you're safe, but economically you're wrecked.
Right.
You know, this is the way empires end on a regular basis. I feel like there's something else that we're missing here. As far as it feels like the conversation so far has largely revolved around that assumption of a DM and a group of players that are all moving in the same direction. And I think one of the key components that we need to address here is, if you're running a campaign, and let me just reiterate this just as a brief aside. The word campaign itself comes from military campaigns. It's the Peninsular campaign. It's, you know, it's the Winter campaign. It's the Wilderness campaign. Mm-hmm. That word was applied to episodic adventures in role-playing games, but it's a holdover from miniature war games. And it comes to us from military campaigns.
Yeah.
You know, when you run a campaign in a milieu, you start off with a band of characters and they go off and they run, if you're doing a lot of combat, a series of fights in the same way that you've just scaled down a military campaign. So just keep that in mind as we move forward. But when we talk about a wargaming campaign, that's not the way those work. The way those work, and even the initial D&D campaigns, they were PvP. Mm-hmm. And so when you've got multiple players, like, it's easy to just hand wave away resources when the players have just as much resources as the DM thinks is appropriate. But what do you do when you've got five different nations that have to manage their resources in a way that is consistent and trackable and auditable? You know, hey, I'm sorry, wait, your guys marched across 1,000 miles in a week. I'm calling, you know, BS on you. DM, can we get a ruling? Can they do that? Maybe they can, maybe they can't. But the point is that maintaining a consistent time frame and maintaining consistent logistical demands, whether it's food or hiring mercenaries or, you know, what have you, that level of consistency is necessary for adjudicating player versus player conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that might be what was lost when we stepped away from PvP games. We no longer needed that leveling foundation of, you know, of a universal logistical system.
Right.
And moved into DM fiat, and we lost part of that. And we lost our ability to appreciate and enjoy the rivet counting aspects of military campaigns.
Right. Yeah, and this is something that you see in, like, when you watch Secrets of Blackmoor and you see the way that kind of Bronsteins were played, the assumption was that everyone was controlling kind of a different faction. And that's an extremely uncommon style of play these days. And so I think you're right in that as RPGs moved into more of a cohesive group activity and less away from PvP campaigns, the need for that kind of strict resource management fell by the wayside a little bit. Now, I will say...
Yeah, you know, but I'll also push back on that. Like,
okay,
that style was abandoned by the tabletop community for a long time, but it was picked up by the LARPers who ran with it and spun gold out of that for decades. The whole Camarilla was a war game campaign that primarily revolved around social warfare. And instead of armies on battlefields, you had a clandestine war that was fought in the shadows. But it was still, you had factions and you had universal time constraints and you had resource management concerns for those players. And I think it's interesting that as the IP known as Dungeons and Dragons moved away and left that money on the table, the IP known as Vampire the Gathering scooped it up and had a lot of fun with it. And not a lot of people make that connection, but it's still there. And interestingly enough, once the LARPing started to die down, I think I know it still goes on. I'm not saying it's dead, but once that kind of hotness wore off, they started moving away from it. Other people picked it up. There may be some sort of a law of conservation of complexity or law of conservation of logistics that's going on here, that if those guys aren't going to use rivet counting, I might as well do it.
Yep. And I think it's easier to kind of keep track of in something like a vampire LARP than it is on an army scale. Because again, with a vampire LARP, in a lot of cases, you are, you know, dealing with a smaller group of people. Now you do have your lords who, you know, like whoever's LARPing as the king of whatever city you're playing in has more logistics to worry about than everyone else. But for, you know, your average individual vampire player, they're just worried about their vampire. And so there's only one person to worry about logistically in that case.
So correct me if I'm wrong on this. There were hierarchies built into the factions where not only did you have the interfaction play, but your character was attempting to rise, to climb the ladder within their own faction as well, correct?
Right, yeah.
So you actually had, and I think this is another case where you've got the game operating at two different levels. You've got that interfaction play and the inner faction, inter and intra, happening simultaneously.
Yeah.
And that's happening within the confines of an RPG.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know where I was going with that. But I know where it is because you're scaling. And also because you've got this ability. And I think tabletop role-playing game, I know for a certainty, tabletop RPGers do not want to sit within a hierarchy. Like, they're all special snowflakes. I cannot tell you how many times I've sat down at a table and I'm the new guy at the table, and I think, okay, you know what? All I want to do to find my legs is I'm going to be the bodyguard for somebody at the table. And I go around and I'm like, okay, who can I work for? Who can I be? And nobody wants to, at the table, you know, dozen times, nobody at the table had any interest in managing any sort of hierarchy below them. It's not until in the last couple of years that I found that to be the case, that people are willing to go to other players and say, hey, how can we help each other out? What can I do for you? How can I serve you? You know, how can I serve you as a means for elevating myself? And I think that's something that tabletop RPGs have left like on the floor. And there's a lot. And I think there's parallels here, kind of dovetails with what I was suggesting earlier. there are ways to explore the game space that are largely untouched because our hobby has been doing things in a given way for 40 years. Right. And if you're comfortable with playing another ABC campaign, a great, more power to you. But there's a lot of us out here that are interested in exploring how can we manage the sort of interpersonal hierarchies within the game space that the LARPers did for so long. You know, how can we do that in a way that is fun and manageable? And how can, you know, there's exploration there that's untapped. How can, and, you know, we're exploring the Adventure Conqueror King scaling issues. Not all games handle that well. And I think also this might be a good time to talk about the fact that who was your guest last week? Gillespie?
Yep, Greg Gillespie.
Yeah, and he, again, correct me if I'm wrong, he didn't have an end game. Like, his, the OSR product that he's producing, he didn't have any interest in this, right?
Right. His argument was that the end game of role-playing games, and specifically his role-playing game, Dragon Slayer RPG, was essentially bigger dungeons with more powerful monsters in them.
Okay. So what he has done is he said the game space I want to explore is mazes and monsters, and maybe even pushing the limit. How complex can we make the mazes? How powerful can we make the monsters? And how can we scale that small band of door kickers in? And you know, that's a worthy space to explore. I think the product that did that the best in third edition was X-Crawl, where, you know, there was very little time spent outside the dungeon. Like X-Crawl, it was basically Smash TV, the fantasy game show. Are you familiar with that one?
With X-Crawl.
Yeah. Which is fine. I don't think that every RPG needs to segue into mass combat. I can think of a few that don't. I don't think like Star Wars needs that. That's possible, but I don't know. What's do you want mass combat in a clandestine war game like an X-Files or Call of Cthulhu? Right? Can you imagine mass battles in Call of Cthulhu? Those campaigns are holding the line. They're you know, facing your doom with as much dignity as possible. It doesn't need it, but it is a realm worth exploring.
Right. Yeah. And to use an example that Crafty Matt used in chat here, something like Savage Worlds. I love Savage Worlds. It doesn't end in mass combat because that's not how the game's designed. It's designed to basically be a pulp story or an action movie simulator. It's not designed to simulate this kind of domain play like AD&D was originally designed for.
Yeah, they actually went to great pains to make it scale between individual combat and skirmish level.
Yeah.
Like once you get up above, I don't know where the limit is, but like about 20 figures on the table, that's when it starts to get a little too complex and start to break down for you, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Which, again, that's fine. But, I mean, if you're talking about Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, you know, if you're talking about Adventure Conqueror King, if you're talking about trying to replicate that journey from zero to king, if you're a king, you're going to need an army. That's just part of the process. That's just definitionally, you got to worry about those things.
Yep. Yeah, and to go back to a point that you were making earlier about kind of hierarchies at the table, you know, there is this interesting idea where no one wants to enter a campaign as Robin. No one wants to, you know, come in as someone's sidekick or underling and then kind of work their way up into their own, you know, like the way that Robin does in DC Comics, kind of, you know, spinning off into the Teen Titans and becoming Nightwing and all that. People don't seem to want that. And I think this gets back to something that Jeffro was talking about when he was on the show. There's this kind of loss of decorum that we've gone through, this kind of loss of social grace that a lot of gamers have experienced where, you know, it makes sense to people of a different generation to, okay, I'm the new guy. So I'm coming in at a, you know, a kind of lower social status than everyone else. And now it's incumbent on me to ingratiate myself to these people and to earn my way into a social hierarchy. If you start talking that way around modern gamers, they're going to like pull out pitchforks and torches and run you out of town on a rail because you're, you know, being a toxic, awful person or whatever. But in reality, that's just kind of normal for social situations. The new guy in the office is the new guy in the office. Why is it any different for the new guy at the role-playing table?
I think this largely ties back into the mistake of rulings, not rules. People are absolutely fine with starting out at the bottom rung of the ladder, but the only person at the table that they will take orders from is the DM for some reason. Like we have this dichotomy that the DM is on this side of the screen and the players are over here and they have two completely different roles. And they really don't. They're all players. I mean, they have different roles, but there's no reason that the guy on this side of the screen should have that much more power than the people on this side. Ultimately, he should be a neutral arbitrator. And this goes back to what we've talked about earlier in the discussion about allowing for more campaign creation on the part of the players and kind of suppressing the idea of the DM as the one person you can trust to do right by you. And trying to adopt a more, you know, when you give everyone at the table ownership and you say, you know what, it's not just the DMs. And it's really weird because this happens in every table I've been to where, you know, ultimately we know the DM has to respect his players' wishes. Now, he's the final word, sure. But we've gone around the table and said, hey, you know, we screwed up this round of combat. How far back can we like rewind things? Or do you think it's appropriate for this NPC to join us given what we know about his history? And everyone shares that input and everyone has some say. And sometimes we convince the DM to see things our way and sometimes we don't. And I think that's strange, right? Like, why am I okay with Bill being my first level magic user's mentor and handing me spells, but I'm not willing to give that same power to Brian, who's got a fifth level magic user.
Right.
Like, why aren't we willing to cooperate on that kind of a relationship between our characters when it's, you know, our players have the same relationship, you know, player to player versus player to DM? That's odd. And I have to think about that, man. I think there's some really interesting discussions to be had around that.
Yeah, and I do agree with you that to kind of bring that state of mind back, the first thing we have to do is kind of take away this notion that the GM, and I fought to like firmly establish this notion for most of my career as a role player, but the GM is not God. The GM is the referee. The GM is the person with the rule book who is able to make rulings based on what people are doing, appealing to the rules, not to his own authority. And so in that regard, the GM...
In miniature war games, he's often called the umpire.
Yeah.
I don't care if the Tigers or the Cubs win. I just want to make sure the rules are followed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it's a close call? All right, listen, you guys don't need to worry about it. I'll make that call for you. That's what a DM is. And so that gets back to what you were talking about with we need to move away from the adversarial. Like, this is another conversation that's going on now that I think is great. The DM players should not be an adversarial relationship. It should be cooperative. And it shouldn't be subservient in one way or the other.
Now, I do think in situations where GMs are, you know, running the like adversary monster. So in a situation where you have kind of a cohesive group against a GM who's now running all the NPCs, I think for the sake of camaraderie, just like around the table, the GM shouldn't be afraid to like, you know, bust balls or things like that and be a little bit of a, you know, you guys aren't going to be able to take this guy down. That's what I mean when I talk about kind of defending the role of the adversarial GM. You're there to kind of irritate the players into being like, we're going to get that guy.
Iron sharpens iron, and hazing is an important ritual to ensure that the guys you're going into battle with can withstand the pressure.
Yeah.
I 100% agree with you. But again, you know, it's one of those cases where, you know, we're fighting in the trenches together, and my ultimate goal of challenging you is to bring out a quality of play that you didn't realize you were capable of.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's, you know, the language on that is a little bit wonky, but I think we're in complete agreement on that one.
Yeah.
But and, it would be, I tell you, it would, that one of the most fascinating campaigns that I watched develop in real time had no NPCs. And this was the Brovenloft. They're going to do Brovenloft 2.0 coming up here in a couple of months. And it literally started out as guys calling dibs on domains. I'm the vampire. I'm the mummy. I'm the lizardman. I'm the pope. And then the DM was like, my job is finished here. Let me know when you guys have to resolve anything. You know, give me whatever secret orders you got, and I can help you resolve those. Mm-hmm. But that was a campaign that had no NPCs whatsoever.
Right.
Unless and until, and what was really curious about that is, I say it didn't have any NPCs, but everyone at the table empowered the DM to run their PC as an NPC. So look, I can't deal with this right now. You kind of know what I'm doing. Just do it for me, and then I'll take back control, you know, tomorrow morning. Just tell me what the fallout is and what the aftermath is. And so there was a lot of like player swapping around, which is another thing people don't generally do. Like, if I'm not at the table with my character sheet, my character's not there. Like, why can't you run my guy as an NPC? We moved away from that at some point. And again, it's a trust issue. I think that there's, you know, when you're surrounded by people that you trust, you can do so much more with these games than otherwise.
Right. Mm-hmm. And Crafty Matt here brings up kind of an interesting point based around the hierarchy conversation we were having. He thinks the best way to bring in new players is to bring them in as kind of a retainer role. And I like this idea because it kind of serves the same function as the funnel from Dungeon Crawl Classics, but it's not a group funnel. It's an individual funnel. It's, you know, you're going to come in as the Paladin Squire. And over the course of this adventure, you're going to have opportunities to show your bravery. And once you do show your bravery, that's when the Paladin will pull you aside and say, we're going to make you a Knight Boy. And that's when you get your first level. That's a cool idea. And that's something that I like.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you've got the beginnings of even a knightly order. Okay, I'm first level. I'm going to have different duties and obligations. And when you're using Jeffrogaxian timekeeping and you've got downtime to fill up, now you've got issues where you can start delegating, you know, your player character. Each player character doesn't have to handle everything. You know, you can delegate tasks to, okay, your job is to manage our equipment. You need to make sure that the weapons and armor are at 100%. If we need more, it's your job to buy them. My job is going to be to manage, you know, diplomatic relations with the elves. And so, you know, I've got something different that's going on. His job is to manage the infirmary. And so you can accomplish a lot more when you're able to delegate, you know, the authority to different downtime activities like that.
Right.
And again, that plays into the whole team. What's the word I'm looking for? Teamsmanship. Is that a word? Teamsmanship. I get confused sometimes.
I'm not sure.
Team. There's a word. Anyway. You get my point.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, to kind of round out the conversation here, there's a couple questions that I've starred as the conversation has gone on. And I want to kind of circle back to some of these topics. We'll start with kind of a light one here. From Crafty Matt, is Battletech a war game or a board game in your eyes?
I reject the premise of the question entirely. I don't see that there's a distinction between the two.
No, fair enough.
I mean, like a tabletop miniature war game just has fuzzier outlines to things like hills. And also, I should say, I don't have a whole lot of experience with Battletech. Most of what I know comes from the memes thrown out by, like, that Nebraskan guy and Crafty Matt and Crossface Killa. I think he's one of those guys, yeah. Too.
Yeah, Crossface is definitely...
It's on my bucket list. I really want to try it sometime. But yeah, aside from like living vicariously through you guys, I couldn't speak to it.
Yeah. I also have never played Battletech, so I don't really have an opinion one way or the other.
Yeah, my understanding is it can be played equally well either way. I'll tell you, I would, because I like the aesthetics of the blurry lines better. When I do play it, I will likely not play on a hex map. I like Hex Encounter just fine, but I'd prefer like fuzzier hills and fuzzier edges to the woods. I like rulers more than counting squares.
Yeah, that's absolutely fair. Now, another question from the wonky Keelan Halverson. This is back on the subject of kind of rivet counting and resource management. He brings up this idea that the problem isn't the expectation that you manage resources. It's that the tools that we use to interface with that idea, the rules for resource management, are clunky and not fun to interact with. What are your thoughts on that?
I think they're fun. I mean, I like the management system as elucidated in Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. I believe that there's the domains of war, domains at war, again, Alex Macris. A lot of people enjoy that process. I don't know how to answer that question. It still sounds like a matter of taste to me. I suspect that there's a rule set out there. And whether it's written or not, I couldn't say. But I suspect that there's a rule set that codifies this well enough for it to be enjoyable. You know, when you look at video games like Civilization, it's a resource management game. You know, you look at all the Hex Encounter War games. I don't know what to say. I think it's just a matter of taste.
Yep. Fair enough. And now on a completely different note, and this is going to be kind of an oddball question, again, from Crafty Matt. He says this question has to be asked, relating specifically to BroSR rhetoric on Twitter. Why Muppets? He wants to know, is this a litmus test, proof that players drive the game and not the DM? Or, you know, if you can take Goofy seriously, then you're playing the game right. Thoughts on the Muppet discourse and what it truly means.
Let me expand the scope of the question a little bit.
Okay.
Why do we use familiar IP at all? Why would you name your character, your first level fighter, Conan?
Mm-hmm.
Why would you name your first level wizard Doc Brown? Macho Mandal is one of the most famous examples in recent memory.
Yeah.
When you start with Sam the Eagle as your character, everybody knows what Sam is like. You've created a shortcut to understanding who and what your character is all about. You know he's not going to be the funny man. He's going to be a straight man that sets up all the jokes. You know he's going to disapprove of everything. You know he's going to be patriotic. So you've already, like, it's a shortcut to get to the exploration of the characters. Part of it, I think, is just that, and I think part of it is that you're hobbling yourself. The most impressive use of Muppets that I've seen, what changed my mind, was Count von Zarovich, which was run by Dan Davies in Brovenlaw. And he said, I'm going to be the vampire and I'm going to be the count. And so instantly you're not taking him seriously, but he created a backstory for the count that was filled with pathos and it made you root for him. And I, you know, you, this is like anything else. When you borrow themes from other, like when you borrow IP, it starts out as a caricature, but as you go and as you spend time interacting with this character, the decisions, the challenges that character faces are different from those in the IP where you found him. And the solutions to those challenges are different. And over time, that Muppet takes on a personality all its own. The Count in Brovenloft is nothing like the Count on Sesame Street, and right, all to the better for it. So those are kind of just some like basic tier thoughts. I'll say this. I don't know that it's for everyone. I think it is a very difficult thing to do to be able to bring a Muppet in. And it doesn't, obviously it doesn't work in every milieu. It probably isn't going to work in Call of Cthulhu. Probably. Hmm. Well, will it work in Star Wars?
Well,
I mean, hell, half the characters in the movie are Muppets, right?
Yeah.
You know, why does Yoda work? Yoda's a Muppet. And he's an amazing character.
Mm-hmm.
So why not, you know, Fantasy Yoda?
Yep. I understand what you're getting at here as far as it's a shorthand. It's a way to get across a baseline point and then, you know, the foundation's already laid by just saying, you know, this is the character that I'm bringing. Like when you name your fighter Conan or you name your thief Gray Mouser or something like that. You set a foundation that people can then, you know, everyone understands where you're starting from when you throw something out like that. Now, I also see where you're coming from as far as, you know, when we think of Muppets, you know, is everything that comes out of the Jim Henson Creature Shop technically a Muppet? Yes. So this includes the Farscape characters. This includes Yoda. This includes, you know, the Skeksis from Dark Crystal and these, you know, the Sesame Street, you know, the Muppets, the like proper Muppets. This is a broad spectrum of character types and characterizations here that you're dealing with. But I do think there is an element of if you get it, you get it. And it is kind of a shibboleth that people like Jeffro use, where if you're willing to kind of look a layer deeper, then, you know, Jeffro is kind of willing to have that conversation with you and people are willing to, you know, kind of let you in. But if you immediately see Muppet and then turn up your nose, it's a sign that, you know, okay, you know, maybe this isn't for you.
Maybe this isn't the table for you. Yeah. I think there's something to be said for the fact that there are certain, kinds of characters, and we see this in professional wrestling.
Yeah.
You know, Simpsons characters. If I'm going to play a paladin and I'm going to name him Ned Flanders, like these genres are built for shorthand and they're built for caricatures that grow over time that allow you to get stuck into that character right away and then start to kind of explore the full ramifications of that character. Everybody knows who Ned Flanders is, and if you've got a Ned Flanders paladin, like, you don't waste any time presenting his personality at the table. Got it, Ned. Okay. But with lay on hands. Okay. So I think there's some truth to that as well, that when you paint with big, bold colors, it really frees you up in a lot of ways. It's an efficient way to communicate characters. So, you know, whether it's Muppets, professional wrestlers, Simpsons characters, I mean, we can go down the line, or, you know, anime characters, I guess some people enjoy that. I don't know.
Yeah. I think, you know, Dunder Moose kind of makes a good point here. You're playing with people who speak your alignment language. If they're able to understand what you're Absolutely. Doing, if they're able to, you know, take the ball and run with it, then, you know, it's like, you know, Gygax lays out in the concept of alignment languages, you are playing with people who understand things at the same level that you understand them. And that's kind of what we're all looking for in our campaigns.
Sure.
And on top of that, some people think it's funny, and sometimes it is funny. So
we're here to have a good time. I kind of think it goes without saying, like, read the table, guys. And this is a bit of a self-correcting problem, because if we've had guys that tried to run that and it was really boring and nobody interacted with them and they dropped it after a couple of sessions because they weren't getting any interaction. You know, it wasn't like an aggressive, you're not allowed to do that. It was just people weren't interested. And so it's kind of this ties back to what we talked about with a random hex generator. The same thing happens to players. If you've got a character concept that's really tedious and dull and nobody wants to interact with it, you're not going to pursue that very long. You're going to start looking for the things that people want to engage with around the table. And, you know, you pick the wrong Muppet and people don't engage, you're going to drop it. Or if you try to put, you know, Rizzo the Rat into a Call of Cthulhu campaign, it's going to break the mood. No one's going to have a lot of fun. And you're going to find yourself disinvited, you know, not because you're being a jerk, but because, I mean, there are certain fundamentals of the genre that you have to adhere to if you want to sit at the table. And nobody advocates for interjecting Muppets into places where, but that gets into the subject of theme and things like, I've tried to play horror games with D&D, and the core skeleton of D&D is not built to replicate the experience of Call of Cthulhu. So things that work in D&D or Traveler, they're not going to work in Call of Cthulhu. Things that work in Call of Cthulhu aren't going to work in D&D. Sanity mechanic in D&D, it doesn't make a lot of sense. The Call of Cthulhu D&D just didn't work. It's flat. It's the wrong tool for the job. So Muppets aren't universal. I just advocate for them whenever you can get away with it.
And there's a flip side to the Muppet discourse as well, in that it's also a protection against people who aren't team players. Because if you have a player who is going, you know, my character is super serious and he's not going to associate with his Muppet foolishness, what that person is inadvertently or maybe advertently telling the table is, I am not going to work with you. I'm not going to participate in the way that you expect a player at this table to participate. I'm shutting myself off from what's going on here. And if you have a GM that is kind of immediately shutting that down and not rolling with the punches, then as a GM, you are telling the players, I am putting up boundaries. I am, you know, walling off certain aspects of this. And again, that's that idea of I'm putting my vision above what you guys want to do. And ultimately I am imposing restrictions on your imagination. So it kind of works in two ways as a litmus test. It's one, I like to have fun and I'm, you know, giving you a fun shorthand that you immediately understand, but also I'm willing to work with you guys and roll with the punches and kind of see where this thing goes, instead of immediately, saying, no, I'm super grim faced, McSerious man, and I have no time for your shenanigans.
And there are even, you know, the AD&D includes explicit instances. Paladins don't work with assassins. If we roll up to the table and one of us is a paladin and one of us is an assassin, we need to step back and we need to have that discussion, and we need which crew is rolling today. Are we doing the super serious, you know, highfalutin heroic paladin, or are we going to get down in the gutter and roll around with the assassin today?
Right.
So it's the same conversation. People get distracted by the bright colors and the funny voices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's kind of, I call that the game beneath the game. There is that kind of social order of, some guys really like to take command of a table and they really like to take charge and kind of direct things and keep us on focus and keep us on track. And, you know, those guys typically become the DMs, or if there's a couple of guys like that, then there'll be one on each side of the screen. And some guys are like, look, I want to hang out, crack some jokes, and I just want to lend support. And, you know, all of us wear different suits. You know, we cross those boundaries. Some days, look, I had a bad day at work. I came home and fought with the old lady for an hour. And now I just want to sit here and roll some dice and kill some orcs. You know, tell me what we're doing and I'll do it. And then the next week you had a great day at work. You know, the wife was super cool. You know, you had a good date with her the night before. And so you show up and you're like, I got some specific plans. Here's what I want to do. Let's what we do. And you have that negotiation. And that's all like just, that's just real people stuff, man. That's like just being a regular person and just being generous and appreciating that you're spending time with your friends. And sometimes you're going to go bowling because Bill likes bowling. And sometimes you're going to play darts because John likes darts. You know, it's just the nature of the beast. We want to get all bound up over it. Settle down.
Now, unfortunately, we are kind of running short on time. And there's several topics that I would love to explore with you someday in the future.
You want to do lightning round? We can do lightning round.
Well, I don't know if we can do lightning round with this one, because I want to at some point talk with you about faith and fantasy, because you know you and I are both very religious, very openly religious people on our
platform. I'm in favor of it. Next.
Me too. But I do have one last question for you before we call it a night. Everyone gets asked this question when they come on Rolling Bones. The answer can be as philosophical or as sophomoric as you want it to be. If you could put anything on a t-shirt, what would it be?
My instinct, this reminds me, somebody asked last night, if you could name the first city on Mars, what would you name it? And everybody was like, Helium. Oh, I would name it Barsoom City. Oh, I would name it after Kepler. And I was like, bro, I'd name it Mollusk. Like, if you could name the first city on Mars, name it after yourself, man. That's immortality. Yeah. 1,000 years from now, people will be saying, why is this place called Mollusk? What's that?
I said, welcome to Ryanville.
Yeah, exactly, right? Which is me buying time because, I mean, anything that I'd want to put on a t-shirt, I pretty much already have. Man, I wish you would have asked that an hour and a half ago so I could mull it over my back brain. I don't know. It's already probably been put on. I don't know. One of the shirts that I'd like to get, I need to get a shirt with the little Von Day cross, the Sacred Heart on it. Like a little fake Von Day patch. I think that could be fun. Or one of the things on my Christmas list is a shirt that it's got the pattern of a French, it's got a French Napoleonic cavalryman. I can't remember. It's not a lancer. I think it's not a cuirassier because they've got the breastplate. It's like the light cavalry. What are those guys called? Hussar. Like the French hussar, like straps and the buttons, and it's really cool. So I'd probably get one of those. That's my dream shirt.
Now, would the hussar shirt also have wings on the back?
Oh, this is the French hussars, but I'll bet you, because they have the British one too, but the French had the styling, and you know, if you're gonna go Napoleonic cavalry, you gotta go with the hussars. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Gotta bless them, gotta respect them. Today's their anniversary, right? The September 12th.
Yep.
This is the anniversary of old Jan's charge into Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
Good call. Good call. This is why you're the DM, because you make those connections, Ryan.
Thank you. Well, guys, that is going to do it for Rolling Bones this evening. John, thank you so much for coming on. And I will say you are welcome to come back on anytime. Any topic you want to discuss, just let me know and we'll do this again sometime.
Thanks for having me, man. This has been a lot of fun. It's been a real change talking about this stuff like adults for a change. So I really appreciate it. I would absolutely love to.
Sweet. And guys, next week here on Rolling Bones, he just did a Q&A on his show, Natural Ones, last night. But next week, we're going to have the basic expert himself back on Rolling Bones to talk about all things Makuhitl. So if you like the Aztecs, if you like Mesoamerican history, and you like White Box D&D, you will want to tune in to next week's episode where me and the basic expert talk all about his Kickstarter campaign for Makuhitl. So I'm looking forward to that. I hope you guys are looking forward to that as well. Definitely check out John's channel, The Joy of Wargaming. And until next time, whether you rolled a 1 or a 20, I'm so glad that you rolled your bones with me, Ryan Howard, and I will see you guys next time.